Look at the Mishnah, which is towards the bottom of Pei Omid Beis, about two-thirds down on Pei Omid Beis.
Wait, Pei? You're on
Pei? Pei, like 80, right? 80B.
Got it, okay.
And we're dealing with the Shiurim of Meleches Hotzah. What's the minimum amount that you have to carry from one Rishus to another? And the truth is that it's all relative to what object you're carrying and what function that object could have. So to do something significant, how much of a minimum volume or quantity do I need? So we start with Adama, and we're talking about earth, and these kinds of Adama were used to make clay. They used to add water, mix it together and make clay. And it was a kind of like a reddish color. That's why it's called Adama, Miloshon Adom, red. And what would they do when they made this kind of a clay? The Mishnah says, Kechosam Hamartzufin. Martzufin. And I think the Martzufin, he says here in Hebrew, Shetzorach lechasima al hasakim. So they had sackcloths, and they needed to make a seal on them. And I guess that seal would identify, perhaps, you know, they had a separate seal for each kind of a sack, maybe depending upon what kind of material they would put into the sack. He writes here, in the Hebrew, he writes, Shahayu osim imenu, from this clay, chosam. Chosam is a kind of a seal. Al hasakim, hasuyim miklipos, eitz gadol. Shahayu osim imenu esaschora, voyum aviram besfinos. So these, I guess, these very large sacks, and they would put the merchandise in the sack and then ship it for sale. And the sacks themselves were made up of some sort of a wood substance. And the chosam, the seal, was made of clay. So how much earth did you need to mix with whatever you mixed it with, some sort of liquid, maybe water, in order to create enough clay to be used as the seal of these sacks that were sent by as cargo in the ships? That's the opinion, Divrei Rabbi Akiva. V'chachomim omrim, kechosam ha'igros. So I guess we're talking about sending documents, and a document had to have a seal. And he writes, "Hayu osam chosam ala igros kedei sheyikra bahen rak mishen ishtalchu a love." I guess it was a kind of a secret way of locking it, like closing up the document in such a way that no one would get access to see it except for the person that receives it.
Sounds like mail.
Right.
Mail. Yes.
Correct. But they would send mail with a seal so that it would be locked up and closed.
Right.
Nobody would see it.
Right.
Now, the impression I get here is that, and we'll see if I'm right, I don't know, is that we're talking about a chumrah here of the chachamim. What do I mean? That from Rabbi Akiva's perspective, if you're talking about seals on sacks, then I think you would need a sizable, significant quantity of clay in order to create these seals, because the sacks were very large. They were, you know, sent by as cargo in ships. On the other hand, letters, which are sent to people, are very relatively small. They're not the size of a sack. So you wouldn't require so much clay in order to create a seal for a letter, for an igeres, and that's a chumra. Because again, keep in mind, the smaller the measurement, the more you're going to be mechayev someone a chatos if he carries out the earth on Shabbos. So the chachov have a much smaller volume of earth, enough to seal a letter. Okay, then we go on to the second round in that mission. That's called Zevel. Zevel is a fertilizer. And Chol Hadak, and fine sand. Okay, so he's carrying these objects, and we're trying to figure out what is the minimum shear for the Chiyuv Chatos. And Rabbi Akiva says, Kedei Lizabel Kelach Shel Kruv, to fertilize a single stalk of cabbage. In other words, let's say you are a farmer and you were growing cabbage. How much fertilizer would you need in order to fertilize the ground so that it would produce a stalk of cabbage? The Chachamim Omrim Kedei Lizabel Kresha. Kresha, Karish, is a leek. And once again, I'm thinking out loud that maybe this is a chumrah. So that both Rabbi Akiva and the Chacham agree that you only need the fertilizer to produce one single plant. But how much fertilizer do you need for a leek? A cabbage is a much larger vegetable and it needs more fertilizer to produce. A leek is a very small vegetable, and all you need is a smaller amount. So once again, as we saw earlier in the case of Adama, here too in the case of Zevel, the Rabbanan are being more machmir. They're being stricter because they just require a small quantity to violate Melechas Otzah. Now we go on to stage number 3, and this is called Chol Hagas, coarse sand. I'd love to know where you find this sand. So the Mishnah says, how much sand of this Chol Hagas do you have to take out? Here the Gemara, the Mishnah doesn't quote a machlokes, but it seems like everybody agrees that it's Kedei Liten Al Melo Kaf Sid. Okay, the language here is very challenging. I have an English translation here, and he says that it's the measure, it's the amount of sand that's contained in some sort of a lime sand mixture. In other words, apparently they would mix sand and lime, and the Gemara is going to explain why they did that, and that's going to be the amount that we're chayef for. Then we get to a kana. What do you do with a reed? It's like a piece of schach. He says, Kedei lasos kulmus. They used to use it to make a quill. So I guess there was a standard size of a quill. And it was made from reeds. So that was for ksiva purposes, for a scribe. Then it says, Vimhaya ove, it was a thick reed, o merusas, or it was cracked. Then he says, merusak is saduk. Saduk means it has cracks in it. And in such a case, you can't use it for a quill because of these, it's too thick, or it has too many cracks in it. And therefore, we have to find a different purpose for the reed that's thick or cracked. Kedei levashel bo beitza kala shebebeitzim. I guess he would feed the fire with this reed, and it didn't take much of a fire to cook an easily cooked egg. Trufa unesuna be'ilfas. So you had already beaten up this egg. You placed it into a pot. It's mamish ready to be cooked. All you have to do is just light a little fire. And this reed, which is too thick or too cracked to be used for purposes of creating a quill, could nevertheless be used to fuel the fire to cook an egg that's already been beaten. It's all been placed in the pot, so it's ready to go. All systems go. Fine. Now, we're talking about a reed that cannot be used for a pen, for a quill, and then it becomes fuel. The Mishnah teaches us that it's a very minimum amount of fuel, that all we need is the amount that would need to cook this egg in basically a pot that's just ready to go. He writes here in the note that the pot itself, the skillet, was preheated. And he based himself on the Rashash. I don't see that in the Mishnah. We'd have to see why the Rashash insists. Imagine if it's a preheated pot, you really don't need much of a flame. And that's a big chumrah. He says in the Hebrew, based on this Rashash, he says, Medubar b'machvas, a skillet, shekvar chimimu oso. They already warmed it up, they preheated it. Velo tzarch lahamtin ad shetischame. And he tells you to look in the Rambam, in his Pirush HaMishnah, on this Mishnah. And the question that the Rashash is worried about is, how does the Rambam know such a thing? There doesn't seem to be any indication in the Mishnah. Okay, let's start the Gemara. And the Gemara says, quoting the Mishnah, Ad al Melo Kaf Sid. And we discussed earlier that Melo Kaf Sid was the amount of coarse sand that we need to add to this this bowl or whatever it's called of lime. So they added lime, they added sand to the lime. Tana, we learned in Hebraic, they litain al pi kaf shel sayodim. And if I understand correctly, what this Bryce is trying to answer is the following question. Okay, fine, you want to create this mixture of sand with lime, but now you have to ask a different question. Well, what are you going to do with this mixture of sand and lime? And the answer is that you have to strengthen this lime, because it would be used by the sayodim. Sayodim are those who are in charge of plastering. So when you mix the sand with the lime, you end up with plaster. Right? Plaster is something that you use on the walls.
Right.
So the Mishnah says you need the amount of sand that you could use as a component with this mixture with lime, in order to create plaster. And what would you do with the plaster? You would place it on the opening of the plasterer's trowel. Maybe I'm not pronouncing that word correctly. So let's just see in the Hebrew. He says, "Kidei litein al pi kaf shel sayodim, kishir aroi la'ari besid, b'shir sheyesh b'kaf shel sayodin." So I guess the plaster is used some sort of a container, if I understand correctly. He calls it a trowel, and he calls it a kaf in Hebrew. And how much sand would you have to add to the lime in order to fill up this container so that it's worth it for the plasterer to have enough plaster for him to start his work? So the Gemara says, "Mantana dechol ma'ali le lisid." Does everybody agree that it's beneficial to add sand to lime in order to make this plaster? Omar Rav Chizkiya Rabbi Yehudahi. This reflects the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda. The Sanya we learned in the Braisa, lo yosud adam es beso bisid. A person should not plaster the walls of his house with lime. And the reason for that is because of what's called Zecher Lechurban. So this Braisa is addressing Avelus al Yerushalayim after the time of the Churban. And what they did was they didn't want you to beautify your house too much. And therefore you shouldn't use this kind of a Sid. That's according to Rabbi Yehuda. I'm not sure. I have to look it up whether we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. But anyway, this is called Zecher Lechurban and it's a kiyum of Avelus Yishana for the Churban. Then he goes on, he says, there is one case in which you're allowed to use this kind of a lime in order to plaster your house, the walls of your house. And that's called Elim Kain Erev Bo Teven Ochol. He writes, Kedesh lo yehe lavan kol kach. So apparently if he adds kind of a straw or some sort of a sand, then it changes the color of the plaster, and the plaster is a little bit darker. It's not pure white. And I guess the pure white color of the plaster is something that's considered beautiful. Once you darken it, then that detracts from its beautiful appearance. Just one second. Oh, so what we have here is the opinion of the Tanakhama. The opinion of the Tanakhama seems to be that adding sand into this mixture of lime actually detracts from the quality of the plaster that you end up with. And therefore, it's mutter after the churban. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees in this braisa. And Rabbi Yehuda Omer Teven Mutter, if you add straw into this mixture, then that would detract the quality of the plaster, and that's mutter. However, if he mixes chol, if he adds sand into this mixture with lime, also that's prohibited. Mineshu hu trachsid, which in Hebrew is nase chazak al yedei chol. So the sand actually hardens or toughens this mixture, and it actually enhances the quality of the lime and therefore of the plaster that you get from this lime. And the Marshal adds a comment here that even though it does darken the plaster, but nevertheless, since it strengthens the plaster, that's its beauty. And therefore, it's prohibited according to Rabbi Yehuda. So our Mishnah, which speaks about the amount of sand that it would take to add to this mixture of lime, that reflects the Shita Rabbi Yehuda, that adding sand to lime is going to enhance the quality of the plaster. And he writes here, Eina kavanasha asru livnos binyan chazak. You might think that according to Rabbi Yehuda, you're not allowed to build a strong building after the churban is gone, and the sand makes it much stronger. It's attractive. But rather, chachamim hitzrichu sheyasu heker. What Rabbi Yehuda is driving at is that we should create some sort of mental awareness of the fact that we're after the churban. And according to the Chachamim of Rabbi Yehuda, if he adds into the mixture, he adds sand, that's not considered a heker. Then there's no heker. Right? Because by adding this chol, but by adding this sand into the mixture, then it looks like he's strengthening the plaster, and he's lacking some sort of a simon to show that he's not going to do what he normally would have done because it's after the churban. And therefore he should add some sort of a substance to this mixture which would create a heker. So according to Chachamim, before we get to Rabbi Yehuda, it says Irev bo teven ochol. I'm not sure exactly what he means by teven ochol. It seems like he would need both teven and chol, I think. I'm not sure. That's not the simple pshat. But anyway, the bottom line is that the halach is not opposed to a strong plaster on your walls, but rather it's looking for some way in which you indicate that we're after the time of the Churban. Now we have another halach which is also similar, which is called Meniach Amal Ama Belosid. And in contemporary life, they don't even bother with that. What they do is they put up some sort of a sign that says Zecher LeMigdash or Zecher LeChurban. But back in the day, they used to leave actually one Amma square that wasn't plastered. It was unplastered wall. That was even a more profound expression of Avelus. Anyway, it comes out that according to Rabbi Yehuda, the addition of sand into this mixture with lime will produce a superior quality plaster. And that's why our Mishnah seems to reflect what we saw in Rabbi Yehuda. He has a question here on the bottom. I'm not sure I understand it. He says, "Minayin la Gemara, how did the Gemara know from our Mishnah that sand is beneficial to lime, to sid? Shema hayu mosifim chol l'sid m'nesha sid hayu biyoker." Maybe on the contrary, our Mishnah reflects the Shita Rabbanon, but because sid itself, lime, was a very expensive commodity, they would add an extra element of an extra volume of sand, which was a little cheaper, in order to produce the plaster that they needed. And then that would reflect the Shita even of the Chachamim. So even though sand is not a good, beneficial ingredient to add to your lime, don't add sand to your lime according to Chachamim, but nevertheless, that was commonly what they did. They added sand to the lime because they couldn't afford that volume of lime. It's like you water it down, you know. It's like, you know, if you've ever met a survivor, they tell you that in the camps, what the Nazis gave them was watered down soup. It was not like 99% water. It was not soup. Rava Amar Afilu Tema Rabbanon, even if our Mishnah would reflect the Shita Rabbanon, that the addition of sand actually detracts from this combination, this lime. But nevertheless, Kilkulo Zeu Tikuno, that by adding the sand and changing the color of the plaster and making it a little darker, now you're allowed to use it because of the Zecher L'Churban. Because, as we said before, if it was pure white, then you wouldn't be allowed to use it. So that itself made it into a common practice, a common style, that although, you know, if you were to ask a builder whether you should add sand into this mixture, he would tell you absolutely not, because then you detract from the plaster. But the Jewish custom was, because of this mitzvah of Zecher L'Churban, that they would add the sand and darken the plaster as a result. So that itself gives it the status of a melacha chashuva, something that was commonly done, and that was the use for the chol. And that's what we have over here. All right. Now, the Mishnah says, Kana, with regard to a reed, kidei lasos kulmus, to make a quill out of it. Tana, we learned in a brisa, kulmus hamagia l'kishre etzbosav. Ah, once again, the brisa says, okay, you have enough of a size of a reed to create a quill, but what kind of a quill? There's a longer quill, there's a shorter quill. And that's going to be a big nafkamina. How much of a kana of a reed are you chai for Shabbos, for Hotzon Shabbos? And the answer is a kulmus, which is very short. not the longer kumas. Now we're being very machmir here in this price because we're saying that all you need is a reed that size. You know, maybe it's the size of a cigarette. I don't know, and that's enough to create a small pen, and it reaches only the joints of the writer's fingers. And he has in the Hebrew. He says shekach noach lichtov bo. That even though it's not one of these fancy quills that you'll see in the, you know, the old time movies about Britain or wherever, but nevertheless it's functional and it's very comfortable to use. Now I'm not sure what he means by the joints of the fingers. I suspect he means not the first set of joints towards the top of the fingers, but the middle ones. That's what I think. Let me just see if he points out which joints we're talking about. Ah, okay. Let's hold off and see if we can understand it. Boy, Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi had a doubt. He vacillated. Kesher Elyon or Kesher Tachton. Which joints are we referring to? The upper joints or the lower joints? If I understand him correctly, the upper joints would be like, there was a rabbi in my high school back in the day who used to smoke half cigarettes. He would cut a cigarette in half. And it was unbelievable. He would smoke it until literally it was burning his fingers. You know, it's hard to believe that. And he was one of the great rabbis in Yeshiva. He was a very old man at that time. He was actually married. He was married to the Chofetz Chaim's daughter. He came from very, very big Talmud Chach, but he used to smoke half cigarette. By cutting it in half, he would get more for his buck, you know, more out of the cigarette. So I can imagine a quill that reaches the lower, you know, the lower joints, that's probably very, very, very small. Let's just see. He tells you which finger it is because, you know, the size of the finger to the joint would depend upon which finger you're talking about. But the Gemara ends with a teku, and it's a bayah delo ifshita. Okay. Wow, I never knew why they called cigarettes joints. Now I know.
Now you know, yeah.
All right. Now we get to a kana ove. Do you remember that we said that certain reeds are too thick or too cracked to be used as quills? They're not comfortable.
Right.
Maybe they'll rub your fingers and scratch them. So then we make the shear of otzah, kidei levashel bo, it's used as fuel. So the Gemara quotes a brisa again, tana, when it says that you could use it for fuel to cook an egg. So the Gemara says, trufa, the Brisa says, trufa b'shemen unesuna b'ilfas. Right, that's what we discussed, that the pan, the skillet is already prepared, it's got the oil in it, and it's going to basically cook very, very quickly. So you don't need that much of a reed. Omalei marbrei deravina lebrei. So marbrei deravina says to his son, Mish milach beitza kala maihi. Right, the Mishnah says that we're talking about a beitza kala with a kuf. So what kind of an egg is easily cooked? Omalei bea ditziltzala. Tziltzala is a small bird, Of Katan, and it gives birth to, lays an egg, this kind of a small chicken, I guess, or maybe you call it a rooster, no, a hen, and it's Katana Vakala Mishar Beitza. I wonder if it's a delicacy, by the way. Sometimes smaller eggs are very, the famous chefs, you know, they give it to you as special. I don't know. So, my brother Ravina asks his son, who gave him that answer, he says, my timer, why do you interpret that that's called a beitza kala? And he says, and he sort of offers his son two different possibilities. Mishum dizutra, is because of the small size of the egg. If that be the case, Ema de Tzif Tziparta. In other words, there's another bird which is called the Tziparta, and that bird lays an egg that's even smaller than the Tziltzala. Now we'll try to figure out what these birds are. The first bird, which is called a Tziltzala, is called a small dove, like a baby dove almost. And it's based on the Aruch. And the Tziparta is the egg of a hummingbird. That's even smaller, Ishtik. So his son didn't have an answer. Amalei, so he told his father, Midi Shmielach Baha, did you hear anything about this? Maybe you have a tradition as to what the size of an egg we're talking about. Amalei, so the father says to his son, Hachi Amar Rav Sheshes, this is what I heard in the name of Rav Sheshes. It's a Beitzas Tarnagolas. This is an egg that was laid by a hen. If it's an egg laid by a hen, is a mai korole beitza kala? What makes it into an easily cooked egg? Shiru chachamim shein lecha beitza kala levashel yosemi beitzas tarnagolas. The chachamim knew it, I guess, with their wisdom. They investigated all the different kinds of eggs, and they came to the conclusion that the easiest egg to cook is the egg that's laid by a good old hen. He says, Lefizeh, in the footnote, he writes, Eina kavona beitza kala lebeitza ktana. So we're not dealing with the size of the egg, but rather some sort of a physical quality of the egg, that its kala is bashel. It's easier cooked. And when the Mishnah says Beitza Kala should be Beitzim, if it would have just said Beitza Kala, then we might have thought it meant a small egg. But Beitza Kala should be Beitzim means that it's the easiest cooks of all the different eggs. Umayshna. Why is Kol Shiri Shabbos Kigrogeres v'hochikif beitza? In other words, when we try to evaluate the size and measure food stuff, we always talk about a dry date, a grogeres, and here we're using it in terms of a beitza. See, I don't know. I'm not in tune with this question of the Gemara, because I would have said that when you talk about a shear of a grogeres, that's because you're doing a malach in the food. Here we're not doing a malach in the food. We're talking about reeds that are used for fuel. And it could be that a small egg, if you had an egg that's the size of a fig, maybe that's already not, you know, to whom would you feed such a small. So again, when you're talking about the size of a food and you're doing a malacha, chveis tochen, or ofer, mevashel, all those malachas, then I understand kigrogeres. Here, I'm not sure why the Gemara is pushing for grogeres. Let me just see if he adds anything here. Just one second. He says, Kigon, okay, he's quoting Rashi, Linyan Hotzah, Utchino, Ktsira, all foodstuffs are measured by Grogeres, and that's the minimum shear for the Malacha. He says, Lepirusha shel b'no shakvar lebeitza shel tziltzala lo kasha. This question wasn't relevant as long as we accepted the baits of this small dove that we spoke about, a very small egg. Shekol Shiure Shabbos Kigrogeres, Kevin Sheish Lomar, Shema Shekol Shiur Shabbos Kigrogeres, Akavada Shein Sharon, Vishiurim Agdolim Migrogeres. Ach Ein Hakavana Shein Dover Choshu Vipochus Misa, Beitza Tziltzlo Ketana Migrogeres, Lachain Chayval Tzol Kishir, fine. Omnon. Lefi pirusho shel Rav Sheshes Shashir hu the beitzas tarnagolas yoser mikigro geres hikshu shesham mevuar shein shiri shabbos yoser mikigro geres. Oh, I understand. In other words, if we are measuring by the size of the egg, so it could be in foodstuff, the minimum size for a food, for a, you know, a substance of food would be a dried fig. But if you talk about an egg, it could be that there are very significant eggs that are very, very small. So this question would be off base. But now that we have Rav Sheshes, and Rav Sheshes says we're talking about an egg of a tarnagolas, so you're not talking about a very small egg, you're talking about a classic, you know, egg, then why not define it in terms of the universal standard for foodstuff? Amalei hachi amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman gives an answer that we're talking not about a complete egg, but rather ki grogeres mi beitza kala. Now I'm trying to figure out, let's say for argument's sake, I'm just throwing out a number, that the size of your chicken egg is 2 grogros. It's a dried fig times 2. So how long would it take to, or how much fuel would it take, right, to cook half of your beitza kala? So it's number one, easily cooked, and number two, I don't even need the amount of fuel that would cook the entire egg. But rather, all I need is to cook the grogeres' worth of an egg. So if the egg is 2 grogros, yeah, I don't know exactly how you measure this, because what is he putting into the skillet? Is he putting half of the egg into the skillet? I guess that's what he's doing. Let's say he stirs up the egg, right, the raw egg, and he's about to pour it into the skillet. So he pours it slowly. At the point in which he pours a grogeres worth, which might be half the egg, how much fuel of a reed would it take to cook that grogeres worth of an egg? And that's the way the Gemara interprets. Okay, now we get to Daf Pei Aleph Amud Aleph. And we're up to the next Mishnah. Very nice. I really appreciate it when the Gemara gives you like a Mishnah that's very short. You know, the Gemara is short, and then you go to the next Mishnah. Like you feel like, all right, now I'm starting a new topic. Okay. Etzem. Now he's carrying out a bone. Now, what do you do with a bone that would make it chashuv? He says, "Kedei lasos tarvod," which he translates as a kaf ktana. Okay, a small spoon. So I guess they used to take a bone and make it into a spoon. Okay, he quotes here the Rambam, that this spoon was used by doctors to measure drugs in order to administer therapeutic medicine. And that's why this tarvad is a very small spoon, because, you know, these drugs were very powerful, potent, so they needed a small spoon. It's probably like a teaspoon. And why is a teaspoon called a teaspoon? I never thought of that.
Yeah, I don't know. Why? Like,
let's just think about it. Maybe they had concentrated tea? I don't know. Anyway, this tarvot is a small spoon, and it was used by doctors, right? The Rambam says. The Rambam would know that because he was a physician. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, kidei lasos mimenu chaf. Chaf, he says, is a manu'ul, which is a lock. So he has a footnote here that this is based on Rashi, and Rashi interprets that he would make a lock It's very interesting what they did with bones. You know, I'm not sure. I guess these were bones that came from animals. That's what I assume.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you would... I get. You know what? I'm thinking out loud now. There are certain bones that are quite expensive, like enamel and stuff like that.
Right.
Anyway, they were used to make locks. Again, it's very hard for us to... I have a double problem. First of all, I don't know too much about the reality of today. But secondly, the reality of then was a lot different, you know. So I got a double problem when I have to learn these Gemaras and put myself back in a time machine. You know, I don't know if today they use bones to make locks. I don't know. Not sure. Okay, let's go on in the Mishnah. And now we're up to zchuchit, which is glass. So how much glass would you have to be carrying in order to be chayav? K'day ligror bo rosh hakarkar. Okay, let's see what the translation of this karkar is. He says, Eitz katan sheroshol chad, a small piece of wood with a very sharp tip. What did they do with it? So Tiferes Yisrael, he quotes on the Mishnayos, says Eitze Asui Lavir Ben Chute Hashisi. He uses it in the weaving process to separate different threads one from the other. Kideshlo Yistabchu Zeba Ze, they shouldn't get twirled or mixed together. Ukshe Niktam Rosho Mechadin Mechantos Vschusis. So they used a sort of like a shrapnel of glass in order to sharpen this piece of wood and make sure that the tip was very sharp. Interesting. Yeah. In my day, they used to use a knife, and they would take a piece of wood, and you'd chip away at the tip of the wood to get it into a very sharp kind of thing. But they used to use glass for that. And... okay, fine. He has a whole discussion about this. Fine. And now we have Tsrar o Evan. So he's carrying pebbles or stones. Okay. Now what would you do? I'm going to guess what, you know, without looking, because I remember a certain Gemara. This guy could be way off, but I just have fun trying to guess what the Mishnah is going to say here. That you could use a stone... use a stone to cover up some sort of filth or perhaps some sort of a utensil that needs a cover to it. Let's see what he says. So the Mishnah says, "Kidei lizrok ba'of," to throw it at a bird. I think he's talking about a hunter, maybe. And he has a very good sharp arm. He's able to hit the oaf, or maybe get the oaf to run away. He throws a pebble at a bird. I guess you need a certain size of a pebble that would chase away a bird. You know, this sounds like David and Goliath. You know, you see, he uses it as a first slingshot. But in this case, he's slinging it at a bird.
Right.
Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov omer shi'uro kidei lizrok bebehema. Oh, this is a big kula. He needs a larger stone in order to throw it at an animal, not at a bird. He writes here, mishum she'ein adam toreach litol tsror. A person will not bother collecting pebbles. Kidei lavriach of. Why? Sheyochol lavricho bashmas kol.
All right, Bergeron, can you hold on
sure.
Just 1 second?
Sure. So Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov is of the opinion that nobody would bother, you know, collecting pebbles to throw at birds, because all you have to do is just scream at the bird and it flies away. But rather, you would collect a larger stone in order to throw it at an animal. to make sure that the animal runs away, because the animal is not scared by your voice, but it's scared by a pebble, by a very large pebble, a large stone. Now, exactly how large the animal is and how large the stone that it takes to get rid of the animal, that the Gemara is going to cover. But first, the Gemara wants to go back to the Machlokes about a bone. And we say that the shear of an etzem, according to Tanakama, is lasos mimenu tarvad, which is some sort of a small spoon, whereas Rabbi Yehuda says it's to make a lock. And the Gemara thinks that Rabbi Yehuda is being machmir here, meaning he's... by requiring a bone to create a lock. Wait, just let me just go back and so we spoke about creating a lock, and I think what he's saying is that to create a lock, you would require a smaller bone. Let's see if the Gemara is going to bear me out on this. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda is now being... Just one second. No. I'm sorry. Just the other way around. Rabbi Yehuda here is a... Oh, he's saying that it's a larger bone that you need to make a lock, because the spoon, I guess, is very small. Oh, so the Gemara asks, L'meimra d'shiura d'Rabbi Yehuda nafish. Are we saying here that Rabbi Yehuda is now being mekil? He's being lenient because he's enlarging the minimum shear for hotzah, that you're only chayev if you carry a bone that is large enough to create a lock. Hakaimalon shiura derabana nafish. We have over and over again a debate between Rabbi Yehuda and the Rabbanon, and Rabbi Yehuda is constantly and consistently machmir. In other words, let's say you have an object which could be used for two different functions. Rabbi Yehuda is going to choose the smaller of the two functions, the smaller quantity. And that's being machmir. Here, what he's doing, he's talking about a lock, a bone for a lock, and that's a larger quantity. So this seems to undermine, this seems to contradict the consistent view of Rabbi Yehuda that we're always going to be machmir and we're going to look for the smaller shear. Omar Ula, the word chaf in the Mishnah, which we said was referring to a shoe. I'm sorry, I keep making that mistake. That we said it was referring to a lock, is chafe posachas. He's not talking about the lock itself, but rather shine hamanul, the teeth of the lock, right? Every lock has to, you know, the teeth on two sides that they fit into each other. We're not talking about the lock itself, but rather the teeth. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda, and this is consistent with his shita, is always going to take a chumra, and here he's going to set it up as a much smaller shear than even that small tarvah. And Tana Rabbanan, the Gemara wants to know what's the status of chafei posachas, these teeth that are used to close the lock, as far as tuma is concerned. And it says here, tahorim. In other words, these are only teeth. They're not the lock itself, and therefore they don't have the status of a kli, of a utensil. They're only part of a greater utensil when they're attached to the lock itself, the structure of the lock. But kvan biposachas, once he establishes them as part of the lock, then tmeyan, then they will be makabel tuma, because now they have the status of a kli. You know, this reminds me of, let's say if you have a pot that you use for cooking. So they used to attach and we still have it today. They used to attach a loop, would serve like as a handle. Maybe they put two loops. So it all depends. If it's permanently attached to the utensil, then those loops become part of the kli. And here also, I think what he's saying is that he took the teeth and he put it into the lock in a permanent way. And therefore, they are part of the kli, they have a shem kli, and they're makabel tuma. Oh, so now, in the note here, he has a whole discussion about kli eitz. In Kabbalah's tuma, a wooden utensil is different than every other utensil. And a wooden utensil could only be makabel tuma if it has a receptacle to it. Now, we're not talking about a receptacle, about a kli kibul. But apparently, etzem, which is a bone, has not the status not of a wooden kli, but rather of a metal kli. And a metal kli is makabel tuma even if it doesn't have a base kibul. And that's why these bone structures of locks and so forth are makabel tuma, because they don't need a base kibul. They have the status of a kli mateches rather than a kli eitz. I think what we're saying here is that every kli is mateches. Mateches is a general, generic term for all utensils, with the exception of something that's made of metal. Now the Braisa continues, and it says, Shelgal, what if he makes a lock out of a gal? Gal, he says, is the deles of a binyan. So I guess he cuts off a piece of the wooden door, and he uses that piece as a lock, and he attaches it to the door. Now, you and I would have said the following, that since he detached this piece of wood from the door, it becomes a separate entity. And if it's a separate entity, then it should be makabel tuma. Because we just finished saying that these items have a shem kli. Oh, but now he attaches it to the door. Ukvan b'masmerim. And he mamish attaches it in a very permanent way. He puts nails in to attach the lock to the door. Tahorim. Now at this point, this loses its independent status. Why? Because it now becomes part of the delis, because he nailed it down to the door. And what's the status of the door? The door is not makabel tuma. Shekol ha-mechuber l'karka reu k'karka. Because only kelim ha-mechabel tuma, that's movable objects, but not something that has a din of karka, is attached to the karka. So the delis is now attached to the house, which is mechuber l'karka. And anything that's mechuber l'karka is not makabel tuma. So let me just see if I can summarize this. He says the following. That if the lock is attached to the, he calls it a gate, we called it a door, and it's fixed to the door, and he secures them with nails, then tahorim, they are tahor. Just one second. Oh, I'm not sure. He says anything that's attached to the ground has the status, it's treated like the ground, and it doesn't contract tum. It's not susceptible to tumma. Okay, I think that's more or less what we said. What I'm a little confused about is, what are the words afalpi? Let me just think for a second. No, I don't know. Okay, zchuchis. We had a piece of glass. Kidei ligrar bo esrosh hakarkar. So we had that utensil that has a very sharp, you know, point to it to separate different threads, and to sharpen it, they used to use a piece of glass. Okay, what's the size of this glass? Tana, we learned that it rises schuchis, which is another way of saying glass. Okay, sometimes we call it schuchis when it's transparent, and schuchis is when it has like a mirror kind of image. Okay, different types of glass. Is kidei liftzoa ba shnei nimim ki achas. So I guess when he's weaving, lachtoch shnei chutim, he's able to take two threads and cut them. I don't know what he means by cut them. Maybe it means he's detaching them from the rest of the cloth, and he could do this bevas achas. Okay, that's the word ke'achas. He says, shir ze shovel l'shir ha'nitzvah kidei ligrar bo esrosh ha'karkar ha'nizkar v'mishnasenu. Okay, fine. So that's equivalent to what we said in the Mishnah, that you can sharpen this piece of wood. He says the weaver would cut excess lengths of warp thread. So you have excess thread, and he needed to use a piece of glass. So the glass itself was used to cut these two threads that were excess threads. So we have now two understandings of the shir of zchuchit. One is to sharpen the point of the front point of this piece of wood, and the other is to take the glass and cut two excess threads. And the Meiri writes, these are both the exact identical shear. Tsraro Evan, kidei Lizrok Ba'of, the Tanakhama says a small pebble that you need to throw at a bird. Rebbe Lozer ben Yaakov says, no, you need a larger stone to throw at an animal. Omer Rav Yaakov, Omer Rav Yochanan, Vehu, he's talking about Rebbe Lezer. Rebbe Lozer says that you have to be able to throw it at an animal to get the animal away from you. Shemarageshes Ba. In other words, it's not enough just to scare the animal, because for that maybe a smaller stone would be sufficient, but rather mirageshes ba. The animal will suffer some sort of pain as a result of getting hit by this stone. So it's a larger stone that could almost injure the animal. And he says in the footnote, based on one of the Achronim, he says, "Ein odem mechazel atznia." A person is not going to run around starting collect stones that he needs to just, you know, get the animal to run away. It's not worth his tircha, his effort. But if he wants larger stones that he could collect to really, that the animal should really feel it when he hits the animal, the impact. That's the shear of Rabbi Lozer. Kamashi Uro, and what is the size of this stone? Tanya, we learned to the Brice, Rabbi Lezman, Yaakov, Omer, Mishkal, Asara, Zuz. It's got the weight of 10 Zuz. Okay, fine. That's great. I just don't know what the weight of one Zuz is. If I only knew that, then I would know the weight of 10 Zuz. But it could be, I'd have to ask, maybe my sister would even know, because she's to work in the Hebrew University. It could be that we now might have some zuzim, you know, from the archaeologists. I'm not sure.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and a zuz was worth something. You know, right. Two of them, you'd buy a goat. You know, today to buy a goat, you'd probably pay 1,000 shekel. I don't know.
Right.
Okay. Now the Gemara wants to know a different question. In the old days, they didn't have toilet paper like we have, so they used to use small stones. And those are called Avonim Shemekanchim Bahem Bebeis HaKisei. And now, we have someone who comes into the Beis Medrash by the name of Zunin. In the English, he calls him Zonin. In the Hebrew, he calls him Zunin.
Okay.
But whatever exactly his name was, is it a Jewish name or not? Wow, this is a whole discussion here. The Rashbam writes it's the name of a Chacham, of one of the scholars. And he was Jewish, apparently. I mean, if he was one of the Chachamim. But the Gemara seems to indicate here that he was a Nochri, that he was a Goy. Anyway, he comes into the Beis Medrash. Amalu, he turns to the scholars and he says, Rabosai, Avonim shel Beis HaKisei Shi'urin Bekama. In other words, if they had certain kinds of stones that were shaped in a certain way that they used in the bathroom. And the question is, how large of an amount of stone would he be chay for hotzah mirshus l'shus? Because it's suitable for the bathroom. And the flip side of this question is, since he designates that kind of a stone for the bathroom, it's not muktzah. Normally, a stone is muktzah. So what's the shir? Amru lo, the Chacham responded, Kizayis ke'egos v'kebeitza. Now, this is a little bit confusing because why are there three different sizes? One is an olive size, the other is a walnut, and the third is an egg size. So Rashi says that he actually has to use all three stones, one after the other. First, he used a very small stone, and that's, he calls it Lekaneach Pia Nekev Biktana Lahasar Atzoat Vukasham. Okay, and then he uses a slightly larger stone, finally the third size stone. Let me just see if I'm missing something here. He says that when a person would wipe himself, he should ideally use three progressively larger stones. The smallest stone was used first to remove the excrement closest to the anal aperture. The larger stones were used for wiping larger areas in succession. The first stone was the size of an olive. The second was a little bit larger. It was the size of a nut. And the final one, the third one, was the size of an egg. So Chazal were answering Zonin that one is entitled to three stones. Okay, that's as far as Tiltal Mukta is concerned. I don't know what the Gemara was answering Zunin as far as the Shear of Hotzah is concerned. Unless maybe this Gemara is not talking about Hotzah, it's only talking about Tiltal. No, but he wrote, we quoted it before, Hainalini Lischaival Hotzah Asan Mirshusa Rabin. So I don't know, what does it mean that he's only chayav if he carries out all three of these stones? Not sure. Maybe as the Gemara goes along, we'll get a grasp on this. Let's see. Amalahu, so Zonin responds, V'chi tur t'ni, yachnis, tur t'ni, he says, is maznayim, which is scales. In other words, are you telling me that he has to weigh these different stones in order to make sure that he doesn't like overshoot it? And you're only allowed to, you're only allowed to move stones into the Beis HaKisei on Shabbos if you weigh them in order to get to precise weight, he says, "Linyan otzolo shayach zedim kain b'chol shiri shavus yuksha kain." In other words, we don't ask, well, does he have to weigh it in order to violate the melech of hotzon shavus? That we're not going to say. But as far as tiltul muks is concerned, it seems like we really have to measure and weigh these three stones. So nimnu v'gamru, they made a decision. They amdu l'minyan, I guess they voted on this, and gamru, they came to the conclusion based on the majority view that melo hayat, that we're going to allow him to move these stones that he can put into one hand, which means afilu arba v'chamesh avonim, even if he has a large hand, large enough to carry four or five stones, that's permissible. The Rambam, in his code, Hilchos Shabbos Perek Chof Vav, comes to a different conclusion. He says that you can only carry three stones in the hand, and that's called the shear of Melo Hayat. And the Ran adds another twist here. He says that although we had three different sizes, he says that Melo Hayat tells me that any size that he wants to take, and he's able to fit in those avonim into his hand. So let's say he wants to take the smallest size, he can get more stones in his hand. Tanya, we have a brisa. Rav Yossi Omer, what are you allowed to carry into the Beis HaKiseh, these three stones? Kizayis ke'egos v'chabetza. Rav Shimon Yossi, Rav Yossi Omer, Mishum Ovid mutal taltakam avonim shenichsos melo ayat. So I'm not sure. Are these two different opinions? He says, initially, Rav Yossi thought the shear was set at an olive size and a nut size and an egg size. But Zunin says, it doesn't make any sense, because then you're going to have to keep weighing your stones to figure out which of these three sizes it fits in. But rather, shear is kemalei hayat. So basically, what we're seeing in the Braisa is Rabbi Yossi's original opinion, but after Zunin, he has this opinion, his conclusion was melo hayat. Tanur Rabbanu, we learned in the Braisa, Sholosh Avonim Mikur Zolos. In other words, the stones had to be sharp, had to have a certain sharp edge, right? It came to a spitz, as we'd say. Is Mutul Hachnas Beis HaKiseh, because they were functional, they could achieve the goal of cleaning the area. The Kamashi Uron, Rabbi Meir Omer Ke'egos, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Kebeitza. And once again, it sounds like we're talking about Hotzos Avonim on Shabbos. When are you chayav for Meleches Hotzah? And we have here a machlokus between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir says it's Ke'egos, Rabbi Yehuda says it is Kebeitza. Now, it could be that all three stones, in the case of Tiltul, were the same size, according to this brisa. Not the way we said before, that there are three, you know, incremental sizes.
Right.
Omer Rav Papa, Rafram Bar Papa, Omer Rav Chizuk, Machlokes Kan, Kach Machlokes Bi Esrog. The Gemara says in Sukkah that the shear of an Esrog, the smallest minimum shear of a small esrog, is either an egg or the size of an olive. And that depends on this same machlokas here. Rabbi Meir would say that the minimum size of an esrog would have to be ke'egos, and Rabbi Yehuda would say, no, it has to be larger, it has to be the shear of a kibbetza. So the Gemara says, Hasam masnisin hacha braisa. The machlokis there in the Mishnah about the size, minimum size of an esrog is in the Mishnah. And here in the braisa, we're talking about a machlokis of Dine Hotzah and Shabbos. In other words, it's a little bit odd that Raphram would tell us that if you want to know about the machlokas here in the Brice, you have to go learn the Mishnah. He should have said it the other way around. So the Gemara says, Ella, but rather let's reformulate Rav Chizkiah. Ki machlokas b'esro kach machlokas kan. You know, the original machlokas is in the Mishnah of Esrog, and from the Mishnah of Esrog we can draw conclusions here about the size of these avonim, either for tiltal purposes for the Beis HaKiseh or for the shear of Hotzah. So let's stop here. We're up to Omer Rabbi Yehuda.